side to side. This is Young Teeth in the place to be. You know how I deep. Hieroglyphics crew coming to new for you, for you, for you. Check it. Now. Latitudinally, longitudinally, a longitudinal be attitudinally adjusted and reconfiguring what's been the status quo of quotable status. My quotas to go beyond the flow quota. I give you four quotas plus overtime for them solid dollars. The scholars not afraid to get squalid. Holler for I make you holler. Your mind will be torn asunder. Lost and wearing on tundra, tundra. The rhyme rotund arousing, causing carousing, hooting, howling. When I do this 012 thing, it ain't nothing cutesy, no filling, no cake fluffing. Just enough to be completely fulfilling with a half full Philly special flies inside. Half brownies got me deep fried, I'm in it knee deep, why stop? Not even for a minute, man, I keep lines cocked. It's tea time for all you fake soldiers and minute men, take over. I'm the first to break over the hill and return with confirmed kills. My name, a superlative that gives chills, blood curdling. When heard, you can't sit still. Now put that up to your grill, inhale. Holla for I make you holla. Put up the power fist if you're with this. Yeah. Holla for I make you holla. Party people in the place bearing witness. Holla for I make you holla. To incredible acts of mental fitness. Holla for I make you holla. Hieroglyphics, we mean serious business. I got a multiplicity of dope shit to sit them C's in their places, using content and delivery as the basis. Lengthwise, adjacent, rows into slaughterhouse. Grind their flesh and stuff them into intestinal membranes. Package up their portions and sections freshly for any session. Come check T, guaranteed. No fine prints or warranties, just excitement when I use my mind like this. And I like at light speed, there are none like me. I'm unlike anything, so fuck a simile. Summarily, arbitrarily, I'm hemming MCs. Harrowing, eyes narrow in a pensive state. Finna create something fresh from concentrate. Leave you prostrate when I break the floodgates and promulgate. But I make a state of the arts. Rearrange the state of the arts with what's stated. You're flustered, frustrated, flush, faded by the plush, luscious gushes I'm busting. No time to get accustomed, cause I'm readjusting with brand new flows that's just in.
Holla for I make it holla.
1-2 Tajay coming live and direct just for you.
Holla for I make it holla.
From the imperial, invincible, highly visible hieroglyphics crew.
Holla for I make it holla.
Nice with mic devices, the precisest.
Holla for I make it holla.
You know how we do, souls of mischief focus. In your inner self. It's the only place you're gonna find it. Sorry, rewind.
Go ahead, Riley.
Hello, hello. We're back. Or I'm here now in New York. This is Rylan Walker Knight. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm not alone, but I'm not with Mark. I'm with three other fine gentlemen. To my left is Kevin Lee. You might know him from his blog, Shooting Down Pictures and Other Pursuits.
Here I am. Hi.
To my right is Keith Ulick, the editor of The House Next Door.
Hello, Rand.
Hello. And across the little table is Dan Callahan, also a writer for The House Next Door and Slant. And,
hello.
We're sitting here after dinner and some cookies and tea, and now there's other super water around, and we're going to talk a bit about criteria, since we're something like critics. And one of my particular interests is how a critic might form one's criteria for judgment and evaluation, as that is our practice in this little world we inhabit. And because I feel like that's one of the hardest things to do is to acknowledge and account for one's taste in forming one's evaluative schema. I really like those Arnaud Desplechin movies I saw this fall. They are all about things I like in really obvious ways to me. I feel like that thing I wrote for The House and the one thing I've already published on Vinyl is Heavy about him are all pretty transparent. Like, I feel like you can see all my education in there, and you can see a lot of me. Like, I tried to make that really explicit in the one I wrote for The House.
Mm-hmm. And is that taste, would you say? Because we're on this idea of taste versus not versus, perhaps taste with and
taste and value, and how and they value. How they interact and how we draw the distinction, and how we see how taste might inform our criteria for value.
Mm-hmm.
and how we judge. And yeah, what I tried to do with the one I wrote for the house is really account for the fact that I just see myself, you know, and like how that might perform. Like the structure I tried to use in that essay was to try to invite the reader to share my experience as ever. Like that's just what I try to do. And so a certain value will be brought about by reading through that redescription.
So the taste is for the movies then, would you say? And the value is inviting inviting the readers
is
to...
trying to, like...
share that experience.
Yeah.
Or share that headspace.
Hopefully that they can arrogate to my taste in some respect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, to me, Stage Door is one of my favorite movies. And I can make a case for Stage Door as one of the greatest movies ever made. And I can watch it practically any time... that like I can just throw it on anytime.
Okay.
I think Robert Bresson's Belshazzar is certainly one of the greatest movies ever made. Do I want to throw it on all the time? No, but I know it's one of the greatest movies ever made. So, what am I getting at? I guess,
well, that's
so. Do you find discrepancies even within your own cinematic value system?
Well, no, I think that it's kind of shifting sands, you know, and it's kind of, there are things that we can enjoy and know that they aren't really very good or that they aren't, and like, I think, I hope that I'm beyond overrating something because it has something in it that I enjoy for some disreputable reason or for kind of a low grade reason.
See, you're throwing a lot of words here that we have to unpack. Like, what's a disreputable reason for liking a film? Is there such a thing?
Well, I think it depends on the person. I think there certainly is such a thing. And I think that we all have different disreputable reasons for liking movies. I think that mine are very, very specific. I assume that yours are very, very specific.
But what is it? Is it because it has, you know, is it because it's been lauded by the Oscars or the critics, so it has all prestige attached
well, that's,
to it?
Well, that's a different
Or
thing.
Is it a guilty, trashy pleasure on the other hand? On the other
well, I'm with Charlie Taylor personally in believing that there are no guilty pleasures. I don't feel guilty for watching, you know, the things that I enjoy. That said, disreputable.
Surely, though, I think that, you know, like I think that a guilty pleasure doesn't have to be an umbrella or something like that. But I think there probably are certain things that are guilty pleasures. Like you're watching and you're going, oh, this is really awful, or this is
like
even
SVU.
A little offensive. Or
I'm not guilty about liking SVU. I mean, I get, no, Law and Order Special Victims Unit, for those not familiar with the
So why do you enjoy watching that?
Well, the partnership between the two lead characters, for example, which I think is somewhat connected to a Mulder and Scully thing, since I'm a big fan of the X-Files. No, that's there. You know, beyond that, I'm
sure. Why do you like that particular thing, that partner thing?
They have a chemistry together that's just interesting to me, you know, and beyond
that. What's interesting about it?
It's a sublimated romance in the sense that it's like the X-Files. It's like two people who are in love with their jobs, and by working, they're actually enacting a love affair with each other, even though they're not physically intimate. It's like by doing their work, they are.
So that's the kind of bone structure of why you like the show.
Well,
but then on top of it is trashiness.
No. it is trashy, and it's not just that. You know, I mean, I'm also fascinated personally by the Law and Order things. First of all, I think it's because I did grow up with them, and since I'm a New Yorker, in a sense, you know, they were always there in some way, shape, or form. Because it started in 1990, Law and Order, the regular show, and it was just like. You know, it was like became part of the kind of New York state of mind consciousness. So you couldn't avoid it, first of all, if you were a native New Yorker and watched TV and such. Secondly, it is what I'm saying about the relationship between the things. I'm also fascinated, though, by the politics of the show because it's a procedural that essentially can go back and forth between being liberal one week and conservative the next.
Well, it seems awfully conservative whenever I've
and I would say
it.
For
and
I would
offensively so.
Well, yeah, and I would say for the most part, especially with Special Victims Unit, it be
these perverts.
I wouldn't even necessarily though call it at this
viewers.
Point. I don't know. I don't think I'd call it necessarily conservative or liberal in this case. I'd say it's just. It's hysterical.
Yeah.
I think hysteria is not necessarily, you know, relegated to either conservative or liberal ideology.
Yeah.
You know, it's but it's a hysteria that I find fascinating because it is a sexual hysteria. And well, I think, you know what? I mean, not to get too deep into personal things, but I think that, you know, sexual hysteria is a part of my life in some ways.
Well, you know, I want to kind of bring this back to the issue of value. Just listening to you, I mean, you know, it's not so much whether or not SVU is trash or not. It's because the way that you describe your engagement with it, just, I mean, it redeems it beyond any sort of, you
know, and again, I don't feel, I don't
evaluation.
Yeah, exactly.
It's activating a certain generosity on your
part. So in some ways, you know, maybe it's not so much disreputable works, but disreputable modes of interacting with a work.
I mean, as I think about it, that show is it says a lot of things that I really don't believe, and yet it stokes something inside of me that actually I feel is fulfilling. I recognize why, say, Dan, you know, looks at it and really doesn't get much out of it. You know, that's fulfilling. As a matter of fact, I think it's kind of repulsive to you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. and you know, maybe that's an example of something disreputable. I mean, I understand that this thing is repulsive in a lot of what it's saying, and yet there's something about it that engages something in me. And I don't, you know,
well, I think that speaks for itself. I mean, I don't think that needs any defense.
Well, and I mean, and I'm also not one who says, you know, we have to eradicate the works we don't like. I'm absolutely against that. You know, it's kind of like,
well, we can ignore or repudiate them.
Yeah, but I mean, I get something out of it. So
what do you get out of it?
I've just explained what I get out of it. It's you know, I've explained that, you know, there's the, what?
Well, no, yeah. I don't quite know what you get out of it. It's like it reflects something in society.
He just accounted for it. It gives him a.
There's several different aspects that I was trying to break down. You know, there's the partnership between them. There's the hysteria of the tone of the piece, which is interesting to me, and which I get something out of by, you know, it's sort of like you know, reading Armand, for example. Right. You know, I will put that out there, which is increasingly less and less a priority for me. But there was something about reading this really other, you know, antithetical to me tone that actually helped to contribute to something in me. I'll use another example that I still do is Ray Carney. You know, Ray Carney does things and writes in a way that I find really reprehensible. And yet, by going to it at times, it actually helps to balance me out in a strange way. Hmm. You know, it's like you engage with a lot of different things to sort of settle yourself emotionally, ideologically, etc. You know, if you just keep to your rigid point of view, you know, I think it becomes a kind of myopia. And so, you know, I try to open myself up to a lot of different experiences, and that is a particular show that, you know, gives me something. Hmm. Towards that end. And I don't think it's just a disreputable thing either. I mean, I think that, you know, there are other superficial things, you know, like I think Christopher Maloney is attractive, you know, or another thing, I enjoy procedural plots, and I'm very interested in television in general, just in the sense of how, you know, the two forms of narrative in television kind of being the sort of week by week procedural, where everything gets kind of reset, you know, week to week, and it's a new story, and so another writer comes on and sort of gives their impression, or a director, and it's kind of like, who is the auteur here, you know? And in Law and Order, it usually tends to be like, you know, just the overarching Dick Wolf perspective, which is a very bizarre kind of near right wing perspective that kind of takes over. But still, within that, then you get like some of the procedural elements of it that I just respond to, you know, from like liking Miami Vice and other things. And then, you know, the other mode that I love is the overarching narrative, like what The Wire and Twin Peaks and The X-Files have in there. And probably the reason I like The X-Files and the Chris Carter series so much is that those series tend to alternate between the overarching narrative and the individual narrative.
So are you always able to justify things you enjoy? Always?
Probably not.
But you would say you don't have to.
Therein lies the challenge of life and of criticism. If we were able to account for everything, then there wouldn't be anything to do.
You know what? I guess it depends. If you're talking as a critic, I think that in my, and this is a personal value, I think that in my thing I would have to justify everything that I like, and I'm increasingly getting to that point. So I say to myself, you know,
as a writer, as a speaker,
as a critic, you know,
there are things that I can enjoy,
yes,
that I wouldn't write about, or if I had, like, I would stay away from writing about them just because.
Right.
Preserves a certain experience.
Aura, I guess. I would have to if I did write about it, because I know it's not very good, but I enjoy it. If I wrote about it, I would have to write about how bad it was. I couldn't write about how I enjoy it.
Well, it's sort of like I really liked, a few years ago I read something Charlie Taylor wrote where he talked about, you know, the pornography that he likes to watch. Hmm. And I actually, you know, you kind of laugh when you hear that straight out, but it was like he was direct about it. He said, you know, I think we have to account for these things. And I think that's something that I agree with.
It's iffy.
Well, I don't think it's iffy. I mean, I think if you...
It depends on how you think it. I think that
if you're going to talk about something, then you have to account for it. So, like, for example, I've said to people that I would stand up in front of a mass audience at, like, the Walter Reed or something with Crystal Skull. I'd go through it frame by frame, and I would justify each frame of that thing. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely would do that and feel that I could do that. As far as something like Special Victims Unit, I probably wouldn't stand up in front of a crowd and justify it, but I feel like I've given here in this conversation some insight as to why I like it. But
what about something that you know is good? You know it's good.
Yes.
And you feel you should like it, but you admire it, but you don't really have real personal enthusiasm for it.
That's probably John Dielman. You know, I'm thinking about that right now because I was thinking, should I go check it out again? But, you know, the first experience of it was so boring to me.
Well, for me, I was thinking about it because of they put out that Bud Bedeker Western set, mm-hmm. and they were showing them on Turner Classic Movies yesterday.
Yes.
And that's a perfect example of, I can admire what he did, but do I want to watch them again, or do I have any real personal enthusiasm for these kind of small morality play westerns?
I have a feeling that it's something that that's akin to me with Ozu, who just the experience of watching any of his movies so far has been extreme boredom and ultimate forgetfulness, mm-hmm. ultimately, and yet, I kind of acknowledge that he is an important figure. And yet, I don't think I'm the one to talk about
him. But
you
don't have any personal.
I have nothing to say. And the fact that I love Naruse is, you know, is interesting to me. You know, or even
they're very different.
Or even seeing the Kisuke Kinoshita film with Hideko Takamine and Tetsuya Nakadai, the name of which I forget. You know, that struck a chord with me, and that was the only Kinoshita film I saw. And I have 24 Eyes, or is that what it's called?
24 yeah.
Eyes 24. Over there. You know, to take a look at, and I'm excited to look at it because I sort of made a connection with Kinoshita on that one film. But I've seen like five or six Ozu films. There hasn't been a one that's like stoked me yet. Now, all that said, I was kind of down on Mike Lee until I recently saw Happy Go Lucky, and Happy Go Lucky was like the thing that like sparked, you know, something in me that kind of made me.
I never liked him.
But that
film is a revelation.
But that kind of made me think. You know, like, for example, I didn't think that he had much of a visual style, and then mm-hmm. I looked at that movie and I was like, my goodness, I think I'm missing something.
It makes
here.
You want to revisit all of his previous films,
yeah.
just to see if that look was there,
and what
but
I
no
was
one ever
missing.
Talked about it.
Yeah, yeah, but you know, it was like similarly with Bresson. I did not make an immediate connection with Bresson. It took a while, you know, where I was just saying, okay, I can respect Balthazar, or I cannot see the brilliance of Balthazar, but I don't really get it, or I can see the brilliance of Pickpocket, don't really get it. Then I saw Diary of a Country Priest, and suddenly all of the previous experiences suddenly clicked into place.
See, it's opposite with him, because you know, I love Balthazar and Mouchette, and Diary of a Country Priest, and Pickpocket, and Man Escaped, I don't really like. I mean, I've seen them once in a while ago, but I didn't really like them.
Right.
But so his 50s movies I don't really like, but
that's
the 60s movies I love.
That's mm-hmm. actually counter to how a lot of people react.
Because
to
the 60s like movies always seem more sexual and more interesting.
Yeah, they're a lot more visceral.
And can I just say, because I want to, his Joan of Arc movie is really, really good. And it's a movie that, you know, everybody says, oh, it's, you know, it's not been one of his best, and it's not.
Well, people always compare it to Dryer, which is very unfair.
It's extremely unfair.
I haven't seen it, but I imagine that those are just two completely different modes.
Yeah.
It's so strange. And
I don't
beautiful.
Know how you could discuss the. I mean, those right, two exactly. guys are just doing something completely different. And no, with it, sensation and representation. That
my experience of that film was, you know, I was watching it, and it was just watching it. And then
which one, the
Bresson Joan of Arc. I was just watching it, and it was really having, I thought, no effect. And then it was just like it got to the ending, and I won't say what the closing like sequence slash.
Well, she gets burnt.
But what I'm saying is like what the final
spoiler.
But what the final sequence of images is.
Right.
You know,
it's very unexpected, and yeah. I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Pauline Kael in her review complained about what the hell does this mean? But that's what it's suggestive.
Yes.
The fact that it doesn't mean anything literal or that you can put it's very suggestive.
And that's you know what? It's generous. That's what I'm going to say. I think that's getting back to what we're it's inviting. I think that was your word, Ryland.
Yeah. It's sexy. It's the sexiest Joan of Arc movie.
Yeah.
Because all the men are always looking at her while she's in her and it's
voyeuristic.
It's disturbing. Yeah. And it's a disturbing sexuality.
Yeah, but I think what you were saying, Ryland, about something being inviting, you know, or criticism being inviting, it's kind of... And you and I have even been talking this weekend about movies as film criticism and such like that and all that. And how these arts, you know, I think, at least for me, the best of them invite, in a sense. You know, they invite you to kind of interpret them in a certain way. And they're not so concrete about things, you know. But then, of course, and they're not so, you know, obscurantly ambiguous either. You know, it's kind of like an ineffable thing that I don't think I could really put into words.
That too
like
is very
that.
Subjective. I mean, I think I know a lot of people. Some of my best friends cannot stand Bresson because they find him impenetrable. Whereas I can't think of a director who's as, you know, what you see on film is what you see on the screen is what you have to engage with. Just like. Shot, like it's so direct, so blunt.
Right,
it's just
it's very direct. Just, yeah,
yeah, but so
and it's know, kind of like you don't know that it's working on you until you get through it.
Well,
and then
for some people,
like,
it just doesn't work because can't make sense of it because
exactly
the grammar is so different from any other film.
And see, that's the thing too. In the criticism, you have to account for that. You have to account for the people who aren't going to get it in some way.
Do you?
I think so. If not, I'm not saying necessarily explicitly, but certainly implicitly.
Then how do you do that?
Well, I think you do that. I mean, what I was saying is that by inviting the reader into your experience, that's how you can do it. Yeah. If you can get them to share your way of seeing, then that's
how
you
can only go so far, though, I guess, if people just can't see. Like, you can try, but at a certain point, you do have to give up.
No, plenty of people don't see. Nobody sees the way I see, but plenty of things I write get negative comments. You know, it's unavoidable.
What's nice and what like I like the idea of some kind of consensus. You know, some kind of consensus about and like so this kind of this big mountain of things and things are moving to the top or they're moving to the middle or the bottom and we're in our small way trying to help these things either be pushed a little further up or be knocked a little further down or that's what I feel like. I'm partially.
I kind of find myself increasingly against consensus in the way of how it's typically, I think, used or.
Yeah, I'm really wary of communities. You know, like I got that other silly blog, and we got a series on there. What community? We took that from Seinfeld episode when George says, like, you know, you're living in a community, and Jerry says, "What community? What are you talking about?" Because they don't really.
Well, I think it isn't even just about us right now. It's kind of it started with the first movies and the first writing about movies.
Sure.
And and the taste and how it's fluctuated, and we are a part of that, whether we want.
Oh yeah, I'm not going to try and ignore tradition, but what I'm saying is that that might have been just a tangent. That word just is kind of weird to me, and that's what came to mind.
But I think also, you know, to push things up but also to bring some things down as well. I mean, I think that I think that's another form of advocacy is to kind of like, it's not just to push things to the top. It's also to like, it's to like redistribute the balance.
I think the very fact of deeming a film worth talking about, positive or negative, adds to its currency.
Indeed.
I mean,
Yeah, right, because the worst thing is to be forgotten, which a lot of films are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
A good many.
Yeah, and so then maybe an assignation of value is just the actual energy spent. So that's why I have tried to steer clear of writing a lot of negative reviews in the past years. If I turn a blind eye, it's like I am not making that a part of my world in a way.
Yeah, and I think that's why I gave up on making a list this year.
Right.
And perhaps for the foreseeable future, is just because for me it doesn't seem at this point a valuable way of advocating. I think there's better ways to advocate, at least from my perspective.
I don't like ranking things. Like I have.
I do. I like making lists, and I like...
And I'm glad that there are people like him.
Yeah,
I like looking for a pattern in something that they're trying to find some kind of pattern in a career. What are the best films this person made and why? And what does this mean? And trying to lock it into place for myself. I enjoy that a lot.
But I do remember, and I won't mention who the critic is online, or on the podcast, but I remember we did have a talk about someone who tended to find patterns in a given year of films. You sort of dismissed his point of view by saying, oh yes, 2007 was all about Chairs.
Well, that's a different thing. That kind of thing, which movie critics do of trying to see what's around, what's in the air right now.
The zeitgeist thing. That's tedious.
No. Yeah. But like, I think it's what I was trying to, more things that are set in stone.
Sure.
You know, and trying to you know, patterns, and trying to put it together and lock it in.
Well, I'm into that too. I guess what I mean is that the glut of year-end shit is just like just that. It's just, I don't know how valuable it is to have all the 200 plus nerds to say, oh yeah, I like this thing.
You know what? I found in reading them, and I kind of regret saying in a recent. I think immediate impression or something that I wrote it was a Toronto podcast conversation where I talked about the glut of top tens. It was actually before I read a lot of the stuff on the Auteurs site, and I think the way Danny and company presented everything on there and gave this kind of space to people to talk about things, it came across to me as much more individualistic and kind of what I was looking for from an end of the year summation, not like a this is what this year means, but oh, here's what I felt or what I experienced this year, and it seemed less so hardly and harshly definitive.
Right.
And I kind of wish I had seen that before I kind of wrote my, I think, overly dismissive comments about all top tens. But I think that was also just coming from a personal place of I was feeling frustrated by the whole process.
I was definitely happy to contribute to that. I felt very proud that I was the first one published.
It's really a good site.
Torch is great.
It's cool. But again, like there, I didn't rank anything. I put it in an alphabetical order, and then I fudged the rules and put more things from my other list. You know, I don't know. I'm really allergic to rules, I guess. And now I've got this other like blog that's just for me. I don't think anybody's ever looked at it. It's called Vinylist Favorites, and it's just like for every year I just have a not ranked, but like definitely some sort of preferential order of favorites. So I see that as definitely just like this is just my taste. Like I just like these things, and the only reason I have it up there is because this guy that I'm sort of friends with in the Bay Area reads my blog, he's like, well, what do you like? Like you never put up lists or anything. And that would really help me. I was like, okay, I guess it's true. When I started getting really interested in taking movies seriously, lists can be really helpful. They can they can fill up your Netflix queue. They can just give you a lot of good ideas about where to go as a autodidact, cinephile viewer kind of person.
Yeah,
that must be something you're into too, right, Kevin?
Lists as
helpful tools. As much as like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking from my own experience, I've definitely used lists as maps. I mean, I don't necessarily see them as, the specific numbers as having absolute value. I just look for titles that intrigue me within these lists and use that as a starting point to explore. And, with the 1,000 project that I'm working on now, Shooting Down Pictures, you know, the way I see it is sort of like this is the sort of objective that I've laid out for myself. It's to watch all 1,000 films on this list.
Right.
And, you know, it seems completely, you know, kind of arbitrary in a sense. It's like, because that, for one thing, that list changes every year. And like move in 100 titles in and 100 titles out because some guy is, you know, collecting all these lists from around the world and calculating and recalculating the standings, you know. And so, you know, is that list the 1,000 greatest films? No, it's not. I don't buy into that at all. If anything, it's a gimmick, it's a hook to get people's attention.
Sure.
But once you have, I mean, that's what we're all trying to do, is get other people's attention and to be interested in things. Mm-hmm. And so I use that as a way to explore not just the films, but just what is cinema. Like with each film I watch, I take it upon myself to actually really sit through it and sit through my feelings about it, and then try to write just a few pithy but really meaningful and, you know, substantial paragraphs just to get at what I feel is the essence of the film for me. And I found it a really useful exercise. It's kind of broadened me in terms of just watching, you know, going from John Carpenter one day to like Bernardo Bertolucci the next, and then Strophouillet the next day. And I mean, it's really kept me on my toes in terms of
variety.
The variety is great, and you know,
and the need, I guess, to rise to the challenge of each movie.
Exactly. I mean, in some ways, kind of going back to your Bud Bedeker point, Dan, of like, you know, are there some films that I just don't really am not interested in checking out? I mean, I'm not in the mood for. Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, like Woody Allen's Radio Days. I was, you know, in a way, I kind of liken it to going on my morning jog. I'm not terribly excited about it at first, but then what I usually do is kind of like do a little bit of research, and then that's kind of what piques my interest, because then I'm starting to like pull in and kind of shape this conversation that's kind of taken place among like a dozen different online sources, you know, reviews by Roger Ebert or some DVD reviewer.
Because a lot of them that you do, I've noticed, are sort of things that were famous or kind of like they've got their kind of name,
right,
foreign movies or something that are pretty neglected and maybe might not be the best movies in the world or whatever, but have a name for some reason.
And they have there's always something to talk about, you know, whether it's a period or a style or a genre, there's always something. And it gets me thinking in those directions. And so it's been a very good exercise in that way. And then the videos are, you know, kind of like the icing on the cake. So, you know, it's almost like you can do it any way you want. I mean, you can like, you know, take Leonard Maltin's film guide and like cut it up into 1,000 pieces and throw it on the floor and then just pick a random film and just watch it as long.
Actually, I mean, what I'm doing now, or one of the things I'm trying to do, is I have this printout of a Matty Farber collection of criticism that's not Negative Space, but which I found online in PDF files, and I'm actually going through each of the reviews and underlining the films he's talking about that I haven't seen, and trying to catch up on them, and sort of then to understand exactly what he's writing about.
I'm really glad you bring up Manny Farber, because, for one thing, reading him was such a mindfuck to me, because I think I'd gone through most of my life looking at films, you know, in terms of a 4-star scale or a 1-10 scale, and, you know, people like Ebert or, you know, your local film reviewer inevitably indulges in that sense of evaluation. And between him and Pauline Kael, you know, Kael was maybe the first one to kind of jam my signals, because she never gave a rating.
Yeah.
And it was more about just being able to talk about the film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that, you know, she was the first I encountered who did that. But then I encountered Farber, and it was even more extreme, because the thing with him is sometimes you didn't even know whether he liked the film or not. With Kael, you always knew. You know, there was a strong sense of an opinion being formed. But with Farber, sometimes. Yeah, exactly. But sometimes with Farber, he would just kind of give you his play-by-play of a movie, just strictly in terms of shots and compositions and just what a film was doing to you sensorially. Yeah. And that was amazing, because...
Yeah, his essay on John Dielman isn't necessarily...
Yeah.
I find I like the essays in Negative Space. I like the ones with Patricia.
I think those
are amazing, because he's taking it as far as he can. It was like the earlier ones are kind of that clickety-clack.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, after he died, I read it again. And I have to be honest. I got a little tired of him like taking apart masterpiece after masterpiece.
And writing
about Belle de Jour, like Belle de Jour like comes off the assembly line.
Right. I mean, the stuff with Paris is great because there is a dialogue. There's another voice that he has to contend with within the space of his own
and
the writing, and it become like these cubist masterpieces of criticism because after a while you have no idea what to think about the film other than just to think about it as a film.
Like the taxi driver piece.
Oh my God.
They like it, but they take it apart.
And it almost reflects the schizophrenia of the film itself. I mean, that film is a very schizophrenic film.
And interestingly enough, I reread the Jean Dielman essay today when I was trying to decide whether or not I wanted to see it again. And thought, well, maybe Farber and this Farber Patterson essay will provide some insight. It was interesting because, you know, it was like I'd recognize a Farber like construction or turn of phrase, and then all of a sudden it would become like, you know, I guess more feminine in a sense. You know, like Patricia Patterson suddenly interjected herself.
You can tell her voice.
Yeah, I know. But it was often like sometimes in the middle of a sentence or in the middle of a paragraph. So
I think
like,
they did you know, kind of. They were like every comment, every little. You know,
yeah. So it was kind of like it's kind of like that clickety clack, clickety clack, and then
it's taken apart.
Clickety clack. You know, again smoother. Like that. So it's
But I want to get back to Farber and value because I mean the irony with Farber being the first critic to make me think in terms beyond, you know, scale of 1 to 10 type of value, was, you know, I was listening to this podcast that Evan Davis did with Kent Jones after Farber passed away, and it was kind of an assessment of Farber's career. And, you know, Kent had some interesting things, because he knew Farber, he was a good friend of Farber, and he was talking about how Manny, when they were in these conversations, he was actually very obsessed with who was the best. He would ask, you know, what movie is everyone talking about now? What's the best movie now? What's the best movie that I should see right now? Which doesn't strike me as at all of like, you know, having anything to do with this guy who, when he wrote, had nothing to do with like, oh, this is the greatest film I've ever seen. Like, he would never stoop to any sort of superlative along those lines.
Right.
But it seems like, you know, if you listen to Kent and the way he describes it, this was a guy who was actually quite obsessed with the superlative and the best, and to the point that he had to actively resist it by coming up with
this style.
Some other alternative, because he was in, he had this sort of apprehension about not being the best, and so he had to come up with this alternative criteria for, you know, getting beyond thinking in terms of best.
You know what I really liked in that the Kent Jones piece is when he said that Manny Farber towards the end of his life said to him, you know, I really missed the boat on Hitchcock. Poincare would never admit that she'd missed the boat on anything. But he was like, you know, I didn't get it.
And he taught Hitchcock in his classes. So, it's that kind of flexibility, that kind of, you know, catching people off guard and, surprising people with your own generosity that, in my mind, you know, makes Farber a superior critic. Or just, at least, it espouses a value and an ethos towards criticism that I can embrace.
Yeah.
The other thing that I remember from it that was great is, I guess, Kent Jones had written a rapturous review of Lost in Translation. I think Manny Farber said to him, Kent, is it really that good? And that, too. For me, particularly, whenever I write about a new movie, if I write a positive review of it, you really do have to be brutal. You really do have to ask yourself, is it that good? Or is it just good for this year? Or you have to put it in the context of everything you've seen. You really do.
Yeah, it's a monadic reading where you're trying to account for every association that might occur as much as the ones that have or you have right now.
And I think that's value in some way. I was going to say, you know, Farber's value, I think, was, and I think he talks about this, was essentially to try to take himself out of the review. You know, I mean, you can sense
yes and
it,
no,
but that's the I thing. Mean, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like I don't think he uses I ever.
No.
In his reviews, so you never get a sense of the I, but you always get a sense of him underneath the words or something
his
like that.
Yeah. Always there.
He's always there, but he's not. But he's not. You know what I'm. No. You know what I'm trying to say. It's like like he did take himself out while leaving himself in.
I mean,
it's a weird.
His pupil,
you know,
Jonathan Rosenbaum, is like kind of the exact opposite.
He uses I all the time.
And
it's right, and it's good for him.
He makes that work. I think he used to do it better. That's such a weird thing to say, but but that's something that I'm interested in, you know, like how we do navigate the first person is the one of the hard.
Another end of the scale is Pauline Kael, who would always use you.
Yeah, she is.
It was something very, very kind of seductive and bullying about it, because you know she's insisting that you and she are the same voice.
Oh yeah,
it's. But also, it can be an invite. It can be.
Oh, it's very seductive. Oh, I mean, that's why. It's you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a very dangerous word.
Especially if you agree with her, which you probably will or might.
Well, it's kind of hard to resist because in some way she kind of co-opts your opinion by using that kind of directive approach to prose.
And, you know, I think it was because of her using you and Rosenbaum using I that I started using we.
The royal we.
Actually, oh, great.
Yeah, well, we in the sense of, because what we does, I think, is then it involves you in the collective.
Right.
Essentially.
I never.
So you want us all to be communists, Keith.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
I think we is troublesome too, just because it gets back to my worry about arrogation. Like, I don't think.
I'm not going to be presumptuous enough to speak for anybody. Well,
there's no right way to do this. I mean,
this is everything I like too. This is just, we're talking about words and how words.
Can, why you should use them.
Yeah, you know. And that's something that Manny Farber taught me when you told me to go get that book was. Mm-hmm. You just got to be precise, you know. You got to think that every word matters, and you just got to make sure that even how you're going to put together one sentence will speak to every other sentence, if I talk about the thread as my metaphor for the essay, I'm going to need to bring up that metaphor another paragraph, and then again another paragraph, and I'm just going to have to keep weaving that, of course.